The Middle Ages, Part 2, the fourth talk in a series entitled Church History, was presented by Peter Wieringa on April 24, 2007, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay. Well, you'll remember that what we're doing here this week is we're kind of going back and forth through the Middle Ages. And hopefully, as you follow your outline, hopefully you'll be able to kind of keep track of the dates, and every once in a while, a little peg will fall into place when you say, oh, he talked about that at that date and this at that date. I see how those fit together, because we're talking about different trends, different movements, different things going on throughout the Middle Ages. And I am trying to do that thematically, just to give you a frame of reference, but they're running on parallel tracks, these different things that we're talking about. So hopefully your outline can help you keep track of that. I'm going to ask that we, as best we can, hold questions till the end. If I say something really stupid or incoherent, go ahead and raise your hand and ask for clarification. Thank you. But something even stupider than that, then raise your hand and I'll try to clarify it. Otherwise, we'll hold questions till the end, mostly so we can just get them on the tape, get them on the microphone. Let me start off by asking a question. How many of you grew up in the church, and how many of you went to summer camp as you were growing up? Just raise your hand if you went to summer camp. Okay. So would anybody be willing to just briefly describe the experience of not just going to summer camp, but what happens when you leave summer camp? What happens when you come home from summer camp? Is there anything that jumps out? Anybody want to tell me what you remember, what jumps out in your mind from coming back from summer camp?
Like your mom cleaned your room?
Well, not exactly what I had in mind. But that's pretty, that's close, but that's not exactly what I had in mind. Anybody else want to take a stab at it, or do I have to give you all the answer? A dampening of the fervency. Thank you, Jack. I'll pay you later for your... he's the shill in the audience here.
I was just going to say, it was sort of like, you know, they come down because camp is usually fun.
Coming off the mountain. That's right. Well, that is, I think, as best we can think about it in our context, in our day and age. Think about the feeling that you had when you were at camp and when you're experiencing good teaching and you're with all your friends and people are becoming Christians and it's just an exciting time. Think about that feeling that is characteristic of a retreat or of a summer camp sort of experience. And I'm going to suggest to you that it is the same impulse that we have when we want to recapture that. I mean, when we're, think of yourself when you were young, if you had an experience like that, and you're coming away from camp, and you just want to go back and recapture what you experienced at summer camp or at the weekend retreat. Well, I'm going to suggest that it is that same impulse, that same urge, desire to recapture that that feeling of being close to God and of learning and growing that was behind the rise of monasticism in the church in the Middle Ages. Now, we're going to start off here by talking about two institutions that really shaped the church in the Middle Ages. We're going to talk about the rise of monasticism. We're going to talk about the papacy. And monasticism, as we'll come to see later on, had a huge effect on what was going on in the church. It was out of the monastic movement that the reform movements of the church got started. It was also out of the monastic movement, that much of the corruption, much of the decay that was going on in the church came from the monastic movement. There was just so much influence on the church as a whole that came out of the monastic movement. So we're going to go all the way back to about the 4th century and just track very briefly with how monasticism got started, and we'll pick up on it again a little bit later in the lecture in another section. But first of all, I would suggest that there's this urge, if you will, I don't know how else to put it, there's this urge that I would say is virtually hardwired into every human being to try to do something in order to experience greater closeness with God. I think that it's that urge that finds expression in most religious systems. Most religions, I think, express that in terms of trying to find something to do, something to say, some way to be able to be closer to God by doing something. Well, the monastic movement, I would say, that was what created the beginnings of the monastic movement, is as the church was getting started, well, this is actually several hundred years after the church got started, as Christians in the 3rd, 4th century began to look around and see that that there was some complacency going on in the church. Remember your timelines now. It was in 312 that Constantine won the battle at the Milvian Bridge that made him the emperor of the whole Roman Empire. And it was at that time that he legalized Christianity. 325 was the Council of Nicaea. So the early 4th century is the time when the church went from being an outlaw religion and being something for which Christianity was something for which you could be persecuted. The church made the transition then to being the accepted religion of the state. It wasn't the state religion per se, but Constantine himself embraced Christianity to some degree, and so all of a sudden the church has gone from being on the outside to being on the inside, and along with that came complacency, came status, came being a part of the culture rather than being outside the culture looking in, and along with that then came the beginnings of some corruption and some decay that some individuals looked at in the church. And they said, we need to get away from that. We need to get back to the basics. We need to get back to a more pure, a more basic, a more truthful understanding of who God is. And so that in my mind is something that is built into every human being. And in the early church, it was no different. Monasticism, as we think of it now, was absolutely unknown in the first couple centuries of the church. You didn't have a monastic movement. And when I talk about a monastic movement, I'm going to explain to you here in a minute, it began just with individuals, but by the time of the Middle Ages, it was a huge movement incorporating tremendous land holdings, thousands and thousands of monks and priests. I mean, it was just a huge movement by the time you got to the middle of the Middle Ages. But in the 1st and 2nd century, and well into the 3rd century, it was virtually unknown. You didn't have a monastic movement of any kind at all. Well, it really began, most people identify the beginning of monasticism with an individual by the name of Anthony, who lived in Egypt. Now, most likely there were some other, they were referred to as desert saints, some other desert saints who lived before Anthony. They referred to them that way because the desert saints were individuals who went out into the desert to get away from the world, to get away from the temptations of the flesh and all of the allure of society, to get away and to be able to experience communion with God one-on-one out in the desert. So there were the desert saints, but then Anthony became famous across the civilized world at that time because of his own personal piety. This was he lived from somewhere right around the middle of the 3rd century to the middle of the 4th century, so his life spanned Constantine's reign on either side. But he's in Egypt. He finds himself, he was a very wealthy young man. He took Jesus' words to the rich young ruler to heart, or at least what he thought were Jesus' words, and he decided to give up all that he had. He made provisions for people who were dependent upon him financially, but he gave up all he had, went out into the desert. And then this funny thing goes on. He goes out into the desert for the purpose of becoming more disciplined in his relationship with God, doing all the things that he felt needed to be done to be alone, to be with God. And this funny thing happens, and that is, as he's out in the desert, as his fame begins to spread, everybody wants to come out the desert and be with him. So here you have this guy who goes out into the desert to be alone in order to commune with God privately. And because that is such a good thing in people's minds, in some people's minds, because that's such a powerful thing that he's doing, others go out in the desert to follow him. So he goes further into the desert, and they follow him further into the desert. And finally, Anthony agreed. He turns to the people who have followed him out into the desert, and he says, okay, you can hang out with me here. You just can't talk to me too much. And so with that, there was a transition from individual desert saints, if you will, who were out in the desert by themselves, to, I call it, a community of alones. In other words, they were all out in the desert, and they were together, but they weren't supposed to talk to each other. They were supposed to they're supposed to experience their own devotion, their own piety by themselves, rather than being too involved with each other. Well, that went on for a little while, and that worked well for some folks. And then a little bit later, there was an individual by the name of Pachomius in the early 4th century. And again, I want to make sure you make the connection between what had happened in the church with the church being legalized and being accepted. And this is the time that the monastic movement really began to take off. And I believe that there's very much a tie between those two things. So you have Pachomius who comes along. He was one of the earliest organizers. He organized a group of monks. That's how they began to be referred to very early on. He organized a group of monks to gather together in community, but his first attempt didn't work. And then what he did was he became even harsher in his demands, even stricter in his requirements for what it meant to be a part of this community, and with that, his community flourished. And again, what I'm going to suggest to you is that that plays into this human impulse that we all have, that if we just do something more, if we just get away, if we just somehow or other work harder, do something more, God will be pleased with us. Well, Pachomius organized this community. The greater demands, the harsher discipline, the greater work that was required of them, the greater devotion that was required of them, made his movement very popular, and many people gathered together. Well, that provided the seeds of the monastic movement, and we're gonna I'm gonna talk about somebody else here in just a minute who was real influential in the early stages, but along with the desert saints, along with the beginnings of those communities, you had what I refer to as the lunatic fringe. And let me tell you just about one who is one of the more famous of the lunatic fringe. For Anthony in Egypt, in the middle of the 4th century, for him, his idea of the way to get away from it all was to go out into the desert. Well, another individual came along significantly later, around 390. He lived from 390 to 459 AD. His name was Simon. His idea of the way to get away from it all was to go up. So he started off with, I think it was just a 6-foot pillar initially. No, it was a 12-foot pillar. He started off taking up residence on top of a 12-foot pillar in order to get away from the world, in order to isolate himself from the world. Well, as you can imagine, I mean, you watch a basketball game, the hoop is 10 feet high, 12 feet, somebody could jump up and maybe hit the bottom of his feet or something like that. That didn't work for him. So the pillar kept getting higher and higher and higher until by the end of his life, 37 years later, he was found living on top of a 50-foot pillar. Simon Stylites, stylist from the word used to describe what a pillar is. Simon Stylites was his name, And for him, getting away from it all meant living on top of a pillar, literally with, he would stand up there and preach sometimes. His food was sent up to him. He would do whatever he needed to do up on top of the pillar, but he lived up on top of that pillar for all those years. Well, all that is just an example of the lengths that people will go to in order to try to get away from it all. That's how absurd it could get to in those days. And I mean, those days, that sort of thing still happens today from time to time. But that was Simon Stylites. After he died, the church in Antioch and the church in Constantinople both fought over his remains, because even then there was a growth of superstition that for Constantinople, they thought that if they had his remains after his death there in Constantinople, somehow or other that would provide protection for them because the city didn't have a wall around it. So you have that sort of thing going on. You have the Bashi who lived in the fields. That was a group of monks who lived in the fields. They grazed grass like cattle. You had another hermit who wandered around naked in the desert for 50 years. And there are all sorts of stories about people who took different paths that in their mind would create in them greater devotion and greater piety that they saw as being essential to their relationship with God. Well, then around 480, there was an individual by the name of Benedict of Nursia, who originated the Benedictine rule. Like so many of these people, at a young age, he gave up all of his earthly possessions. He became a hermit. He was noted personally for his extreme asceticism. And this was, again, a very common theme, that you had to put away the temptations of the flesh. And the more you could do, the greater lengths that you went to put away from you the temptations of the flesh, well, then the holier you would be, the more righteous you would be. Well, he was known for his piety. Disciples gathered around him. He founded a community of monks at Monte Cassino. And what he is best known for was giving to the monastic tradition the Benedictine rule. And at this point, the Benedictine rule was very simple. It involved monks who were a part of the movement taking a vow of permanence. Prior to that time, there was a lot of monastery shopping. You would go from one movement to the next, depending on who had the best music. No, depending on things like that, depending on which movement or which individual you were most inclined to follow. So that was very common. People would go from one movement to another. Well, Benedict insisted on, once you make a commitment, you need to stick with the group that you've made a commitment to. And then he also, part of the Benedictine rule, the other thing that was important was an obedience to the order, and an obedience to the head of the order, who was known as the abbot of the order. So for Benedict, he sort of helped to firm up some rules that gave some more stability to the monastic movement at this time. For Benedict, there were some reasonable comforts that were allowed in the monasteries, but there was also labor that was prescribed on a daily basis, spiritual practices, prayer, devotion, study, that sort of thing. But it was this Benedictine rule that really helped to shape monasticism as it grew into the Middle Ages. Well, just a passing note, I'm not going to go into much detail about this. Monasticism in Ireland absolutely flourished. There's a book that's pretty popular, How the Irish Saved Western Civilization. Does that sound like the right name? How the Irish Saved Western Civilization. It talks about the fact that Ireland was relatively isolated from the barbarians, from all the unrest, conflict that was going on in much of southern Europe. And so in Ireland, as the monasteries flourished, they became an absolute center of learning, preserving documents, training, study, devotion. And from the monasteries in Ireland, they sent out missionaries all over Europe. One of the more famous of the Irish monks was Patrick. We all know the story about Patrick driving the snakes out of Ireland. But the monastic movement in Ireland was a very powerful, very influential movement about this time. Well, now let's talk a little bit about the papacy and the rise of the papacy. If you remember your New Testament, if you remember Jesus' conversation in Matthew 16, we have Jesus with this exchange with his disciples when he turns to his disciples, Matthew 16, verses 13 through 19, and he asks them, who do people say that the Son of Man is? He gets several answers. Some say John the Baptist. Some say Elijah. There are several answers as to who he is. And then Jesus says to them, but who do you say that I am? At which point Peter gets it right here. Peter chimes in and says, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And at that point, Jesus answered Peter, and this is a quote now just from the New American Standard. Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Yonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. I'm going to read that passage again in a minute because it's that passage that provides the biblical foundation, such as it is, for the rise of the papacy. The idea being that Peter, and we'll move on into this in just a minute, Peter in Catholic tradition was the first bishop of the church in Rome, and that Peter had been given by Jesus a particular and unique authority in the church. Now, with that in mind, thinking of Peter, if you were a good Catholic, thinking of Peter as the first bishop of Rome, the first pope, if you will, let me read that passage to you again. Peter answered and said to Jesus, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Yonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. That's a critical phrase that's going to be used throughout the Middle Ages and is a critical phrase in understanding the authority that the Pope believed himself to have and that the church believed that the Pope had. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. That's the theological foundation that the church in the Middle Ages is built on. Well, by church tradition, Peter was probably the first bishop, if you will, overseer. The Greek word is episkopos, the first overseer of the church in Antioch. That's what tradition says. If you read through the book of Acts, it's not that cut and dried at all as to who's in charge of which church or who's an overseer in which church, but that's the way tradition has it. And then later he went on to Rome and became the bishop of Rome. Now this was a title that, again, there is a New Testament word, episkopos, that came to be or later came to be translated or understood to be the bishop. So there is a word that denotes some sort of an overseer, but the church in the very early years did not have the same hierarchical structure, did not have the same order that it came to have much later. But again, tradition reads that back into the very earliest stages of the church and says Peter was the first bishop in Rome. Now, most likely, I think it's tradition, but I think it's quite possible that Peter was in fact martyred in Rome, probably by Nero. There were the persecutions in Rome that we talked about. Quite likely both Peter and Paul were martyred in Rome. But it's interesting to note, and again, this is part of church tradition that has grown up around these ideas. In John 21, verses 18 and 19, Jesus says to Peter, he says, truly, truly, I say to you, when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go. Now this, Jesus said, signifying by what kind of death Peter would glorify God. That's basically a quote from John 21. Well, tradition suggests that when it came time for Peter to be martyred in Rome, He couldn't stand the idea of being crucified like Jesus was, so he insisted on being crucified upside down. And that's where again, that passage in John about him being bound and being taken where he didn't want to go, that was taken as a fulfillment of that passage of Scripture, that he was crucified in Rome. And again, we don't know that that's what happened. That's tradition. We don't clearly know. And there's so much of what has gone on in the church that is tradition, has been handed down for years, but is pretty hard to verify. It's easy to get all sorts of information that would suggest that Peter, some people will say he was never in Rome. Other people will say he died in Jerusalem, that he's buried in Jerusalem. There are all sorts of other traditions and other information. But for the church, the tradition is that during his earthly ministry, Jesus gave him the keys to the kingdom and announced to everyone that the church would be built on Peter. That was the interpretation. Now, there's clearly another interpretation that I think is much more likely. But the interpretation within the church was that Jesus said that Peter was to be the foundation of the church. Upon this rock I will build my church. And that Peter received the keys of the kingdom. Well, just with regard to where things went from there, the title Pope simply means father or papa. There were popes in churches all over the Roman Empire at this time. It was not simply the Bishop of Rome who was known as the Pope at this time. During the very early years of the church, we've talked about this fact, Rome was clearly a secondary church. It was not one of the leading churches in the empire. The church at Antioch, the church later at Alexandria, even later than that, the church at Carthage, those churches were much more important and influential in the first couple of hundred years than the church in Rome was. But, and we talked about this a little bit this last week, the critical event that happened in the West, and again, around 400, 500, 600 AD, we begin to see the empire in the West and the East separating because the capital of the empire is at Constantinople. Their ability to exercise rule in the West lessened because it's a long ways away. They didn't necessarily have the money to be able to take care of things in the West. So the Western part of the empire and the church in the West became more and more distinct and separated from the church in the East during these centuries. Well, as the barbarian invasions were going on, there were a couple of instances where it was the Bishop of Rome who was far more influential, far more helpful in protecting the city of Rome, not just the church, but protecting the city of Rome from the barbarians than was the emperor in Constantinople. Leo the Great is often thought of as the first pope. His dates are 440 to 461 AD. Those are the dates of his rule, if you will, as pope. During this time, the theological movement was going on mostly in the East. Nobody paid too much attention to the West at all. But in the West, Attila the Hun is invading Italy in 452. He's invading Italy. The Roman citizens send messengers to the emperor in the East asking for help, asking for protection, asking him to send an army to take care of them. And the emperor at this point is unable to do that, doesn't have the resources or the will to be able to do that. So Leo the Great, went out, met with Attila, negotiated with Attila the Hun. Tradition has it that as Leo the Great was marching out to meet with Attila, Attila had a vision of Peter and Paul marching with Attila. Now, with Leo the Great, thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Marching with Leo, with Pope Leo. So, again, that's one of those traditions. Who knows, you know, what really went on there? But the tradition is that when Attila saw that, he decided not to go in and sack Rome. And so Leo's stock went way up. All of a sudden, he was far more than just a churchman. He was far more than just the head of the church. He was the guy who had protected and saved the city of Rome. So in the vacuum, the power vacuum that existed in Rome at this time, the popes began to fill that power vacuum because the emperor in the east was unavailable, either by choice or by necessity was unavailable. And so it was the popes in Rome that began to fill the vacuum. The popes increasingly began to turn to the Franks, which was one of the barbarian tribes that had settled in the area that is now known as France. They began to turn more and more to the Franks, who were Christians also, to help protect the church and help defend the church against outsiders. You have Pope Gregory, 590 to 604. Those are his dates. Pope Gregory in Rome was a phenomenal administrator. He organized things in Rome. You can imagine, the city has been sacked a time or two by this time. You can imagine things are in decay. Housing is in decay. It's hard to get food. It's hard to get clean water. Overpopulation. Things are pretty chaotic in the city of Rome. Well, Gregory comes along at this time and helps to get things organized in the city and truly acts as a civil administrator rather than just the leader of the church in Rome. So he takes that responsibility on, helps to organize protection, rebuilding, food distribution. He, in fact, became the, for all practical purposes, became the civil ruler of Rome, as well as the head of the church in Rome. And it was Gregory also, and that's talking about things on a civil or from a civil perspective, but it was Gregory also who took a lot of Augustine's teachings, and we talked about this briefly last week. Augustine was willing to speculate about a lot of things. Gregory would come along. He thought of himself as a student of Augustine, but it was common for him to take some of Augustine's teachings and to revise them and to set them in concrete. So, for example, when Augustine just speculated about whether or not there was a holding cell, if you will, after life, before we go into heaven, he speculated about that sort of thing. Well, Gregory comes along and institutes and sets in stone the whole concept of purgatory and insists that there is, in fact, a purgatory. So that didn't come. Some of the ideas came from Augustine, but it wasn't settled as church teaching until Gregory came along much later than Augustine. Other things that he did, It was Gregory that really began to institute the system of penance, the system of using contrition and confession, absolution, and the Mass as sacrifice for sin. Much of the dogma that became so settled in the church and defined the teachings of the church in the Middle Ages, many of those things came along as a result of Gregory's teaching as Pope in those years. Am I the only one that's hot in here? If you want to open some windows, I don't know if they'll stay open, but if you want to try to open some windows and let some air through, that would be great. Well, we talked about the fact that increasingly some of the theological controversies in the West were alienating the church in the East. They had different priorities some of the controversies in the East, pardon me, were alienating the West. They had different things that they were focusing on. In the West, they had settled on a much simpler Christology, a much simpler view of who Christ was. Now, I said last week that Augustine really didn't have much to say about the Trinity. I should clarify that because some of his writings were gathered together in a book that has come down to us as a book on the Trinity. But what I would suggest, and if anybody, I'm not a scholar of Augustine, especially with regard to that work, so if anybody's got a different understanding of that, I'd love to hear about it. But as I have looked through it, scanned it, I haven't read the whole thing in detail by any means, it seems to me as though what he does in that writing is he just sort of accepts the Nicene understanding of the nature of the Trinity. He accepts that. But then he goes on to speculate on other things. He goes on to talk about how the Trinity reasonably that the whole nature of the Trinity would be reflected in other areas. So he begins to speculate on whether or not man has a tripartite nature. He begins to see threes in lots of things around him. When I say that Augustine didn't have a lot to say about the Trinity, what I meant by that was I don't think he added much new to the controversy that was going on in the East. What he did was begin to elaborate on that with some other speculation, some other ideas and questions about what ramifications that had in other areas. One thing that he did do, that Augustine did do, that became a problem for the church in the East was it was Augustine who began to talk about the fact that the Holy Spirit emanated from the Father and the Son. We talked about that briefly last week. When the church in the West wanted to add filioque, the Latin word that means "and the Son," to the Nicene Creed with regard to the emanation of the Holy Spirit, the church in the West was ready to do that. For the church in the East, that was utter heresy, and that created a tremendous rift between the church in the East and in the West. Well, during this time, and let me ask another question here. Has anyone here heard of the Donation of Constantine? Okay, you cannot say anything else from this point on. Anybody else ever heard of the Donation of Constantine? Okay, anybody who's heard of it can't say anything until next week. The Donation of Constantine...
I can Google it.
See, this is like next week on 24. This is to get you back next week. The Donation of Constantine was circulating, began to circulate sometime in 5, 6, 7, 800. It's not clear exactly when it began to circulate, but the Donation of Constantine was the document whereby, now catch this, catch what was going on, it was the actual document whereby the Emperor Constantine gave to the Bishop of Rome when he came to power, gave to the Bishop of Rome civil authority in the West, recognized that he was going to the East, he was moving the capital to the East, and Constantine at that point gave to the Pope at that time, and I don't even remember the Pope's name at that time, but gave to the Pope, the Bishop of Rome in the West, authority in civil matters in the West because he was not going to be there. File that away until next week, because this will be really important next week when we get to the Renaissance. But the Donation of Constantine, as you can imagine, provided a tremendous support for the authority of the Pope, because here it was not simply a practical matter that the Pope was taking care of things, organizing things, but here's this document that begins floating around here. Here's this document that makes clear to everybody that was Constantine's intent, that the Bishop of Rome have this authority in the West. Well, all this is going on. We talked a little bit about the reign of Charlemagne, the revival of learning and of scholarship that was going on under Charlemagne. Charlemagne was coronated in 800 AD. We mentioned that last week. But at the same time, society and civilization in the West is becoming increasingly fragmented. As the order of the Roman Empire has completely broken down, there are warring tribes, warring groups of people around Europe who are fighting for power, fighting to spread their own rule. And so the church more and more is becoming the unifying factor in Europe during this time. Well, that moves us on to the next section, if you're looking at your outline, the battle for the control of Europe. And I used a phrase in there, I think I have it in your outline still, I used a Latin phrase, Corpus Christianum. What that phrase means, that phrase really defined the church's self-understanding in the Middle Ages. And that is, it was the church's self-understanding that the church was the body of Christ. That's what the Latin words mean, Corpus Christianum. It was the body of Christ that gave unity to all of Europe. That is, all those who were Christians. And by this time, by the time you get to the Middle Ages, the 800s, 900s, 1000 AD, by the time you get to this point, most people in Europe, the vast majority of the people, would identify themselves as Christians of one stripe or another. Well, this understanding that all of Europe was unified as part of the body of Christ became prevalent. And where that becomes important then is, if all of Europe is the body of Christ, who's in charge? Who's in power? Who's in authority during this time? Because you have the Pope. Who's the head of the church? The Pope is the one who, according to the church, the Pope is the one who should be the ultimate authority, who should have the final say on things. But you have civil rulers who aren't too excited about that idea. They don't like the idea of ceding their authority, their rule, to the church. So what we're going to talk about now is this battle for control of Europe, a battle between the church and the state. And that battle was really focused on what's come to be known as the investiture controversy. Now, the investiture controversy comes from the word, obviously the word investiture, and that is, who is it that invests authority to the civil rulers? Now, think about your New Testament, because you can make a case either way here. You can make a case out of the New Testament saying God is the one who has instituted civil authorities. The civil authorities like those verses. But you can also make a case, as the church did, for the fact that it was Jesus who gave ultimate authority over everything to Peter, the head of the church. And so you begin to have this question of who has invested authority in the civil rulers. Is it God who has given them authority directly, or is their authority a derived authority from the church? Is it the church and the leaders of the church who give authority to the civil rulers? Well, I told you the story about Charlemagne. When he was coronated Christmas Day 800, Pope Leo III put the crown on his head. When he leaned over to tie his shoe or something like that, Charlemagne took the crown off and re-coronated himself. So they were both trying to make a statement about who had ultimate authority in that matter. You have the donation of Constantine that's floating around at this time that is influential in suggesting that Constantine had intended that the Bishop of Rome have civil authority. You have that floating around and supporting the claims of the church. And what you have are, in the church, and again, think about Jesus' words to Peter in Matthew. You have in the church these two unbelievably powerful authorities that they have over everyone. And what I mean by that, thank you, the church, as we saw in that passage in Matthew, it is the church and specifically the Pope who has the keys to the kingdom, and that is understood in the Middle Ages basically to be the church has the right to say who gets into heaven and who doesn't. And the way that authority, the way that power is expressed in the church during this time is by two ways primarily. First of all, with regard to individuals, if an individual is not towing the line, they can be excommunicated. Bishops of different churches would excommunicate people, individuals or rulers. The Pope would excommunicate individuals. Well, where this became a powerful tool of the church was if the bishop, or if the Pope rather, excommunicated the King of France or the King of England or something like that, there was enough belief in the authority of the Pope that carried tremendous weight. That was very influential in causing the civil rulers to pay more attention to what the Pope had to say. But let's say you have the King of France doesn't give a hoot about whether or not he's excommunicated, doesn't believe that the Pope has that authority, doesn't believe that teaching. Well, the Pope has an additional authority, and that is the right to invoke interdict. I don't know if you've ever heard that word. Interdict is where the Pope can say about an entire group that the sacraments can no longer be offered within a given country or within a given group of people. So imagine you're the King of France. Let's say you don't care about being excommunicated, but the Pope says that your entire country is under interdict. All of a sudden, if you live in France, you're going to hell. I mean, that's the thrust of it. That's the way it was felt and understood by the people in Europe at this time. The Pope had the keys to the kingdom, which gave him the right to say that in an entire country was outside the church, was outside the ability to receive the sacraments, and so an entire country or an entire group of people was damned to hell if the Pope so decided. Imagine the influence that would have in Europe at that time. Imagine how important that would be in helping to shape what was going on in civil affairs. Well, the investiture controversy, the best story, the biggest story about the investiture controversy, it came to a head late in the 11th century. You have Emperor Henry IV, and you have Pope Gregory, I want to say the 7th, but I don't remember for sure. Emperor Henry IV, who was ostensibly the one who was in the line of the Roman emperors. This is before the Holy Roman Empire was really constituted as such, but he was Emperor Henry IV. He was from northern Germany. Pope Gregory comes along. Well, Gregory was part of a very strong reform movement. Now, let me just set the stage for you. Remember when Humbert went to Constantinople in the middle of the 11th century, and when he excommunicated the entire church in the East? Well, this Gregory was one of his buddies. This Gregory was not the Pope who died. The Pope who died was a buddy of both Humbert and Gregory. Gregory becomes Pope soon after this, and he was part of the reform movement that was insisting on the clergy being chaste, the clergy not having wives, insisted on trying to wrest power away from the civil authorities and have more power rest with the church. All of the things that the church in the East and the emperor in the East didn't like, well, those were the things that Pope Gregory was promoting at this point. He was taking a stand against some of the abuses of the church, taking a stand against simony. Now, simony, again, New Testament, it has its root in the New Testament. The account in Acts of Simon Magus, Simon the magician, who tried to buy the Holy Spirit. Well, simony was the practice that was rampant at this point, this early in the church, the practice of buying a church office. So imagine if you come from a wealthy family, and this particular bishopric, let's say it's the Bishop of Paris, just to pick a city out. Let's say this particular bishopric was a wealthy position. It was a position that had all sorts of power and prestige and money that went along with it. Well, there was a common practice in the church that you could actually buy that church office, or you could buy the abbacy, become the abbot of a monastery. If there was a particular monastery that had great lands, had all sorts of wealth, had far-reaching authority or influence at that point, you could buy the abbacy of the monastery. So simony was the practice of buying church offices. Well, Gregory took a stand against simony. He tried to do some reform with regard to a lot of the political maneuvering within the church. He promoted clerical celibacy. He's trying to reform the church, and part of those reforms was to try to take some of the authority away from the civil rulers. Well, when Emperor Henry IV was young, he was very supportive of the church. When he became emperor, everybody thought that he would continue to be supportive of the church. But when he saw what was going on with this shift of power and this attempt for the Pope to take away from the emperor more and more of his power and authority, when he saw that this was going on, he put his foot down, he exerted his own authority. He wanted to be free to appoint church leaders in his territories rather than have the Pope appoint them. Part of his territory was the city of Milan. At one point, there were riots in Milan over the issue of clerical celibacy. Those were the sorts of things that people went to the streets for in those days. There were riots over whether or not the clergy should be celibate. Emperor Henry deposed the Bishop of Milan at that point, and he appointed another bishop in his place. Well, when Gregory saw that, he told Henry that Henry, had to appear before the Pope in Rome, or that he, the emperor, would be deposed and would be condemned and would be excommunicated. So he threatens that. The emperor responded by calling a church council. The church council deposed Pope Gregory. So this is what's going on during this time. The council that was called by the emperor deposed Pope Gregory on the grounds of tyranny, adultery, and practicing magic. Well, with that, there's a standoff that takes place. The Pope then takes the next move, or makes the next move in the chess match. The Pope places all of Emperor Henry's lands under interdict. And so at that point, all of Henry's support, all of the people in his lands are beginning to get a little bit uncomfortable. Because imagine most of the people truly were convinced that if they died while under interdict, they were going to hell. I mean, they had that firm conviction. So as long as Emperor Henry was in this spit and match with the Pope, as long as this was going on, their very eternal destiny was hanging in the balance. Well, during this time, one of Emperor Henry's staunchest supporters became ill quite mysteriously and truly mysteriously. It's not as though the Pope poisoned him or anything like that, but truly mysteriously he became ill and died. And the people took that as a sign from God that, in fact, God was opposed to Emperor Henry. So at that point, Emperor Henry repents of his of what he had done toward the Pope. He asks to be admitted to the Pope. He asks to go to seek forgiveness. And the Pope makes him pay dearly. I mean, the Pope puts him in a position where he is thoroughly humiliated before all of Europe at this point. The Pope had retreated to a town called Canossa, which was a fortified city, because he expected Henry to come at him with an army. So the Pope had retreated to Canossa. Henry comes to seek an audience with the Pope. He has to walk barefoot through the Alps in the winter, in the snow, and then Pope Gregory makes him stand outside the castle for 3 days in the snow before he even lets him in to talk to him. Well, that's all for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to make clear to all of Europe that the Pope's in charge, that it is the Pope who has ultimate authority in all of the affairs of Europe during this time. Well, that was sort of the high point, if you will, it wasn't quite the high point, but that was the most significant event in this whole struggle between the popes and the civil rulers. That was the time when it was most clearly understood just exactly what the authority of the Pope was. There were ongoing struggles that certainly didn't end things by any means. There were ongoing struggles between popes, temporal rulers, but that hanging over people's head, that fear of eternal damnation if their ruler didn't toe the line, that was very important. That was critical in all of the maneuverings that were going on. Well, the next pope we're going to talk about just very briefly, he'll come up again a little bit later, was Pope Innocent III. Innocent III, his rule was from 1198 to 1216. Innocent III was, by far and away, bar none, the most powerful pope in the history of the Catholic Church. by the time Innocent came on the scene, let me give you the date for Henry IV and Pope Gregory. That all happened in 1077 AD was when that was going on. Well, now we're 100 years later. Innocent III is the Pope in 1198. And Innocent III has his hands in everything. He is the unchallenged ruler of the church. There is good reason to think that he was basically a pretty good pope. He was involved in some of the reform movements that we'll talk about a little bit later, but he had his hands in every court in Europe during this time, had influence all around Europe, and it was virtually unchallenged. He was so powerful, he had so much authority that he pretty much had his way around Europe. Well, that gives you the highest point of papal authority in the Middle Ages. Mark that date, 1216, was when Innocent III died. We're going to jump ahead almost 100 years later, and I'm just going to note for your benefit, we'll be talking about this more in the weeks to come, the beginning of the decline, or where the decline became more rapid, was when Pope Boniface VIII, his dates are 1294 to 1303. He was just in power for 9 years. Pope Boniface VIII, trying to build on the authority that Innocent had and trying to further that authority, issued what was what's known as a papal bull. He issued a papal bull called Unum Sanctum, which basically stated the dogma it set in papal law and in church law, it set the idea that the church had ultimate authority over all of Europe. So this controversy that had been going on and that was played out very practically in many respects under Boniface VIII, he was the one who actually put that in writing as a doctrine of the church. And for the most part, the church had come to accept that at that point. Well, it turns out, and we'll see Boniface again later, it turns out that was really the beginning of a pretty steep slide for the Pope. Boniface himself at one point was kidnapped. He didn't have the sort of power and the sort of prestige that Innocent had by any means, but he was attempting to really legalize and to codify the authority that Innocent had. Well, on to the next section, we're going to talk a little bit about, I call this section the Church Triumphant, and this is just looking at the height of the Church's power and authority and prestige, roughly during the period of what's known as the High Middle Ages, and historians differentiate between the Middle Ages as a whole and the High Middle Ages, which are about 1050 to 1300. The High Middle Ages were a time of relative peace. There wasn't a whole lot of civil unrest. There wasn't a whole lot of disturbance there. There was a real revival of culture and learning, especially in France. The court of France in the 12th century, the Renaissance of the 12th century is a word you might be, or a phrase you might be familiar with. There was a great flowering of culture during this time. But as far as the church is concerned, theologically, this was in many respects the high point of the church because this was the period of time that scholasticism developed. And at this point, I'm specifically going to turn to Jack. I'm just kind of going over what I've studied, but I really have not read much of these guys very much. So if I'm off base on some of this stuff, you feel free to jump in here. Scholasticism got its name from its origins in the cathedral schools. Scholasticism was a movement in the High Middle Ages at this time, a movement that attempted to reconcile philosophy and religion. The goal was to reconcile reason and revelation, just to put it very generally. That was the goal of scholasticism. One of the most important forerunners of the scholastic movement was Anselm. Anselm was the Archbishop of Canterbury. That's England. So you can, again, see here the church is powerful and influential all over Europe at this point. Anselm was the Archbishop of Canterbury starting in 1093. He came into conflict with William the Conqueror. William the Conqueror had come over and conquered England. He was in conflict with William, so he spent a lot of his time in exile, meditating, writing on theological issues. Anselm was most notable for laying the groundwork, if you will, for scholasticism in his attempts to apply human reason to an understanding of matters of faith. And where you see that is, and I've heard Jack talk fairly often about Anselm, so when I get off base here, you correct me. Where you see that was, there are a couple of works that I want to refer to. One of the things that he wrote was the Proslogion, in which he developed his ontological argument for the existence of God. I don't even know exactly what that means, quite honestly, but that's what was going on with Anselm. And the phrase that is used that describes his argument, that when you stop and think about it, it's a phrase that makes a lot of sense. His argument from reason for the existence of God is that God is, and this is a quote, God is that than which no greater can be thought. In other words, think of that thing or that something that is the greatest thing that you can possibly think of. There has to be something that is that great, and that's what God is. And that for him was his proof of the existence of God. Was that at all coherent? Does that kind of more or less cover it?
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, didn't make any sense to me. I'm just, but... And like Jack just said, there's a whole study of the scholastic philosophers and the scholastic theologians that could go into great depth, far greater obviously than we're going to do this evening. Another book that he wrote was Cur Deus Homo, which is Latin for "Why the God Man." And again, I've heard Jack refer to this before, and I try to sort through his observations with what's going on in the history of the church at this point. It's here that Anselm develops his understanding of the incarnation. And the way I would express it is, as he's trying to give rational explanations for why God needed to become a man, part of that had to do with Jesus' sacrifice. It had to do with the fact that in his incarnation, by Jesus' death on the cross, his death had to be something so huge, so important, so huge that it could somehow or other pay for all of the sins of mankind. So he tried to draw a one-to-one relationship between how startling it was that God sent his son to become a man and die on the cross, and that it had to be that important, it had to be that significant, because the sins of humanity were so great. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. The only thing is that we read it recently in our curriculum, and it's not so that we pay for it. That comes later.
Okay.
But the rest of it is exactly.
Okay. Good. Well, that covers Anselm. That's all I'm going to say about Anselm. I'm over my head at that point. Let's talk a little bit about...
The other thing he's most famous for, I believe, seeking understanding.
Right, that phrase.
Borrowing the phrase from Augustine, that I believe in order that I might understand. Anselm really runs with that, and that's what's the foundation of scholasticism.
Okay, good. Peter Abelard, born in 1079, died in 1142. You've perhaps heard of Abelard and Heloise. Abelard was his patron, was an individual. No, I'm sorry, I was saying too many words there. I don't remember the name of his patron, but Abelard actually fell in love with the niece of his patron. The two of them got together, had a child. Abelard was emasculated when that was found out. But the story of Abelard and Heloise is one of those medieval romances. He retreated to a monastery. Later on, he was declared a heretic by Bernard of Clairvaux. Bernard, we're not going to talk much about him. He was a leading churchman of that time. But what Abelard is known for is he wrote a work called Sic et Non, Latin for yes and no. And you think about the title, and that helps to explain what he did in that work. And what he was doing was, his goal was to take all sorts of disparate views from philosophy, from theologians, to take all sorts of disparate views, express all those different views, and then try to reconcile them. Thus the name yes and no. There's this position, there's this position. Let's present them all, and now let's try to reconcile them. And that became the framework, that became the way that so much of scholasticism was taught, by doing just exactly that. Not just presenting one point of view, but presenting several points of view, and then trying to see how all of them could be true. Batting 1,000 so far. That's right. You betcha. So that's Peter Abelard. Peter Lombard, his Four Books of Sentences was a systematic treatment of theology, became the basic textbook for theology in the Middle Ages in the universities. Scholasticism was advanced during this time, during the 11th, 12th centuries, with the growth of universities. So just picture in your mind now, as cities grew up, as the Middle Ages came out of the feudal period, which was based on landed gentry who had castles, as cities grew up after that time, universities grew up in cities, the scholastic movement flourished in the universities, in the cities. And then also at this time, interestingly enough, the teaching of Aristotle was reintroduced to the West, to Europe at this time, primarily by contacts with the Muslims in Spain and in Sicily. So earlier than this, Aristotle had really pretty much been lost, but was reintroduced to Western Europe at this time. Albertus Magnus was another great scholastic. He drew a distinction between theology and philosophy. Albertus Magnus' greatest pupil was, and here we come to the king of the scholastics, if you will, his greatest pupil was Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas was born in 1224. He died in 1274. His writings are universally recognized as the height of the scholastic movement. Everyone would agree historically he was one of the most brilliant men who had ever lived. Comprehensive, voluminous writings. Just a little bit of history about Thomas. He was expected by his Italian family to take a position in the church, but expected to take a powerful position in the church. Instead, he joined the Dominicans, which was a lowly order. We're going to talk about them a little bit later. He joined the Dominicans, so his family locked him up for a year to try to dissuade him, to try to get him back on track. He didn't change his mind. He is known, one of his nicknames was that he was the dumb ox. He was a large man, apparently. But eventually he overcame a lot of, he was initially fairly quiet and shy, overcame that, became known as one of the greatest theologians in the history of the church and certainly in Europe at this time. His most famous works, Summa Contra Gentiles, or Gentiles, and Summa Theologica. At the heart of those works really was the relationship, as was true of most of the scholastics, the relationship between faith and reason, the arguments for the existence of God, and the attempts to reconcile different views, different perspectives on different theological issues, express them, and then see how they could all be reconciled. On faith and reason, he saw that there are some truths that were within the reach of reason, some that were beyond it. His understanding was that philosophy deals with the first, theology with the second, theology deals with the things that are beyond human reason. And again, his goal was to, as much as possible, draw on reason to prove what it is that faith accepts. And his theology, his comprehensive, systematic theological system, absolutely became the foundational teaching and doctrine and dogma of the church at this time. I'm going to look at both Brian and Jack. Anything else to add on Aquinas? Am I?
Yeah, you mentioned the introduction to Aristotle, the two of them have Aristotelian logic.
Okay.
The Middle Ages have been largely Platonist up until then. And he introduces Aristotle and recasts theology into more Aristotelian.
Okay, well, with that, that is just our brief section on the scholastics. Daniel asked last week about the Crusades. I think I will probably just do this section, and then we will, I thought I was going to get through this lecture this time, but we're going to talk about the Crusades. This probably won't take too long. Jump back now, not too much further back here, jump back to around 1095. Remember what the setting is. Remember what the context is. The Muslims completely control what is known as the Holy Land. And at this point, Pope Urban II, who is the Pope in 1095, looks to the east, sees the Muslim control of the Holy Land, decides it's time to do something about that, time to recover Jerusalem, recover Bethlehem, because of how important those sites are to the beginning of Christianity. So he calls for a crusade to the east in order to, and also at this time, the Muslims are pushing their way north and knocking on the door of Constantinople. So now think about the turnaround here. 500 years earlier, the Bishop of Rome was asking the Emperor of Constantinople to come help out in the west. Here you have Constantinople threatened, and the Bishop of Rome calls for a crusade to come help the East, to come help the Emperor in Constantinople, and at the same time to go into the Holy Lands and to push the Muslims out of the Holy Lands. Calls for a crusade in 1095 with a goal of reuniting the empire as well as retaking the Holy Lands. Initially, he calls for a crusade, and initially it is just a mob of people, completely unorganized, completely unstructured, just a mob of people, disorganized. It's the poor, the dispossessed, the people that don't have lands, don't have any standing in society, who gather and just head off to the east to take part in this crusade. Along the way, they are just soundly defeated. All kinds of people die. I mean, it is a complete rout because there is no organization, no structure, nobody running things.
Was this before this letter or after?
Okay. Well, this was coincidentally about 40 or 50 years after Humbert excommunicated everybody. So that's a good point that 40 or 50 years earlier, there was this somewhat official split. Well, here, Urban II at this point is trying to reunite the church in the east, the empire in the east, with the church and the empire in the west. So that's a good point. Well, after the disorganized mob comes along, and all of the bad things, well, it's not fair to say all of the bad things. Most of the bad things that you've heard about the Crusades are true. This disorganized mob heads to the east. They're indiscriminately killing Jews along the way. They see Jews as the enemy, not simply the Muslims that are in the Holy Land, soundly defeated. And then soon after that, Adhemar, who's the bishop of PUY, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Adhemar organizes a more orderly crusade. He gets together with several civil rulers. They join forces with the Byzantines in the east, and they actually have quite a bit of success, about the only success that we'll see in the Crusades. But they take Nicaea, they take Antioch, and then on July 15th, 1099, that's 4 years after Urban had called for the Crusade, in 1099, they took Jerusalem. And all of the horrible things that you can imagine in terms of the slaughter, the rape, the pillaging that is portrayed as part of the Crusades. That all went on in Jerusalem when they retook the city. Jews and Muslims alike were indiscriminately slaughtered. It was just absolutely a horrible, horrible scene. As you read accounts of what had gone on, just unbelievable atrocities. Once they took Jerusalem, there was a real sense on the part of many of the participants, once they had taken Jerusalem, okay, we're done. We can go home. Now, imagine what is going on in the Mediterranean world, or imagine the distances here. I actually thought it would be fun if I could do a map quest and see how far it is from Rome to Jerusalem. I couldn't. But they only cover the United States and Canada. But the distance...
turn left.
Yeah, and swim. But the distance from Rome to Constantinople is right around 850 miles. The distance from Rome to Jerusalem by land is about 1,550 miles. Now, I don't like to drive 200 or 300 miles. These folks are on foot, the vast majority of them. There might have been a few horses, but the vast majority of them are on foot. There's some travel by sea, but huge distances that they have to travel. By the time they get to Jerusalem, they are 1,500 miles from home, if we think of Rome as home. Now, some of the Crusaders came from further up in Northern Europe, from over in Spain, from up in the area of what is now Germany. There were some that that were closer to Jerusalem, but huge distances involved. So after they had taken Jerusalem, a lot of them decided it was time to go home. And for the next 100 years, then, it was a battle for the king of Jerusalem, who was a Westerner. I think Baldwin was the first king of Jerusalem. I don't remember for sure. But for the next 100 years, it was a battle for the Western king of Jerusalem to hold on to the territories, to hold on to Jerusalem and the area around him, always having to fight back the Muslims, always having to have other reinforcements come from Europe in order to help him, in order to help fight the battles. They held on to Jerusalem until 1187. So basically for 88 years, from 1099 to 1187, they held Jerusalem. During this time, again, as you read the accounts of the Crusades and the accounts of the battles that were going on, one of the things that is striking to me is how important or how influential superstition was during this time. You'll read of a group coming and a group of crusaders coming to fight, and they'll get bogged down for one reason or another by disease, by discouragement for one reason or another, and then somebody will have a vision. And there will be a vision of, in one case, there was a vision that there was, somebody's spear, I don't remember who it was, but there was some spear that was going to be used to help lead them into Jerusalem. And lo and behold, they dug in the place that the person who had the vision told them to dig, and there was a spear. And with that, all hyped up and all excited, they went on to Jerusalem. Well, all sorts of stories of rampant superstition that was going on and that motivated the people, most of whom were illiterate, were poor, really had no idea what they were doing. They were simply following a rabble. Well, Jerusalem is lost in 1187. After that, there's one disaster after another. Now, again, peg your time frames. 1187 is when Jerusalem is lost. 1198 is when Innocent comes to power. So you have, in the West, you have the papacy in complete control of Europe, and yet getting organized to send crusades to the East was never successful again. Richard the Lionhearted, I just throw that out because that's a name that we're all familiar with. He was the king of England. When I was a kid, I read Robin Hood. Did anybody else read Robin Hood? Well, Richard the Lionhearted was on, I think it was the Third Crusade. I can't remember which one it was, but He lived right around this time, right around the end of the 12th century. It was his brother John, King John, that the whole account of the Magna Carta, the signing of the Magna Carta, that was in the early 13th century. Richard the Lionhearted went on one of the Crusades to the East, and it was disastrous. There were three men that led the Crusade. One of them died along the way. Richard and the other one got crosswise with each other and began to fight, and so there was just one disaster after another. One of the horrible things that went on during the Crusades was there were several children's crusades. Children's crusade would be when huge groups of children would be gathered to go off and to take the Holy Land. Children, because chances are that their parents perhaps weren't alive, they had no livelihood, they had no way to live, and so they were gathered to go off to the Holy Land. And the idea that was propagated was that because they were innocent children, God would protect them. And God would allow them to take Jerusalem back because they were innocent children. Well, children's crusades, there were several of them that went to the East. Children slaughtered wholesale, taken into slavery. They became slaves along the way. Just the most horrible things that were going on during the Crusades at this time. By the end of the 13th century, the crusading spirit had pretty much run out. They had they'd kind of lost interest in taking Jerusalem at this point. However, that didn't keep Innocent III, Pope Innocent III, from calling for a crusade to go to southern France to wipe out the heretical Albigensians. So this crusading fervor, this mentality, when there was no longer success to the East, this crusading mentality was turned to the West and used against heretics within the church. The Albigensians were a group in southern France that their theology, their belief system was a lot like the Manichees. They were very dualistic. They were condemned by the church for many years, and Innocent actually sent soldiers against them. Within the next 50, 100 years, they were pretty much wiped out completely. It was in the Crusades against the Albigensians that the Spanish Inquisition was started, and we're all familiar with at least having heard about the Spanish Inquisition. That's when the church put in place the Inquisition in order to root out the heresy of the Albigensians in southern France at this time. And that is all I'm going to cover for today. We've got a couple of pages left on the lecture, but we'll pick that up next week. Any questions or comments?
So what was the priest celibacy all about? What?
Well, the best explanation I've heard for the movement toward the celibacy of the priesthood was because priestly positions had become hereditary, just like civil positions. And that contributed to the decay and the corruption in the church. Because just because the guy's your son doesn't mean he's going to be a good priest, a good bishop, a good abbot, or anything like that. So the movement toward the celibacy of the clergy had to do, that's one reason. It had to do largely with trying to get away from passing church offices on that way.
Term limits,
there you go. Yep. But then there was also the idea, and we talked a little bit about that this last week, there was certainly coming into play the idea that somehow or other the clergy needed to be more pure and thus needed to be celibate, needed to be more pure than anybody else. So sexual morality came into play here also, with the idea that that somehow or other the clergy would be better off if they were celibate. So one more here and then we'll...
Oh, just ended that. Also, the guy who went off into the wilderness, that makes me think of John the Baptist, uh-huh, and that kind of thing, and he didn't marry and stuff like that.
Right.
I wondered if that...
Oh, yeah, those were certainly all themes that were picked up. I mean, the whole idea of John the Baptist and all those sorts of things were definitely themes. So,
thank you.
You bet.
One of the things you talked about was quoting from Scripture about Jesus talking to Peter and saying, upon this rock I will build my church, mm-hmm. and you'll have the keys to heaven. And he's, mm-hmm. by tradition, considered the first pope. And you said there's a slightly different meaning that you have about that than traditional church has.
Well,
what is that meaning?
Well, we'll talk quite a bit more about that when we get into the Reformation, because that became one of the big discussions of the Reformation, because the church's position based on Matthew 16 was the interpretation that Jesus was saying to Peter, you are the rock, Petros, stone, is a translation for Peter's name. Jesus says, you are the rock, and upon this stone I will build my church. Well, in the Reformation, and we'll talk about that, it'll probably be in 2 weeks, that was one of the big discussions, was how might that passage be interpreted otherwise in order to give a different meaning. And basically, and I think it ends up being a better interpretation, that basically suggests that the foundation for the church is not that individual as much as it is Peter's declaration that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So it's on that foundation, on the foundation of the identification of who Christ is, that the church will be built, rather than on that individual. But that's a big issue during the Reformation.
I see a little more pagan influence than probably you do in this, because of Campbell and Hyslop and some of the others I've read, because it was the pagans who had the celibate priesthood for a long time. And then also, I agree with Hyslop, because Rome was one of the last of the large cities to become a major influence, and where the Vatican is was a temple. And the priest, he was, one of his titles was Petrus, I think is what it is. And he had two keys that were, I forget what gods associated with. But he contends that by them co-opting that power, they took over a lot of influence, because not only did the Christians see the Pope as an authority figure, but because he had these pagan symbols, the keys and so mm-hmm. on, the throne, that he was able to bring all them in. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things, like I said, the rosary beads, those are also, the title Pontus Maximus was a title given to the pagan priest.
Yeah, there's no question but that there was, very... very prominent in the church in the Middle Ages, all sorts of superstition, all sorts of other influences. As the barbarians came in, they were changed, but they also changed what was going on in the church. So absolutely no question. There were a lot of other influences there. So any other questions, comments before we...
This is probably kind of silly, so if someone has a more important question, but I was just kind of curious how somebody lives on a pole. How big was this pole?
Well, there was a platform at the top, and I don't know exactly what the dimensions were of the platform.
So he could, sleep up there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he slept up there. It was it was big enough for him to sleep on, sit on, preach from. Food was okay. Raised up to him by ropes. Other things were
never mind.
It was
that's okay.
But it was certainly big enough to live on. And as far as we know, it was not. It wasn't covered. He was exposed to the elements. So it was the whole point of so much of the monastic movement, in that sense, the lunatic fringe, if you will. The whole point was to make life so miserable that somehow or other you would prove your devotion, prove your worth, prove how serious you were about your belief by enduring such hardship in order to...
Was not covered at all?
I don't believe so, no.
What city was this in?
I can't remember. He was Rome? Somewhere in... No, it wasn't in Rome. It was somewhere in the Middle East. Pardon? Yeah, Syria. Okay.
Does it get cold there?
Well, it's near the Mediterranean. It's fairly temperate. So,
actually got to be a competition among the monks that had.
And who could have the higher?
Who could have the most outrageous?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
You have actually buried in the pole vault.
Okay.
Cannot be done. We really should end on that.
Yes, yes.
Is that where the tradition came of in monasteries that still happens to this day, the fool for Christ kind of thing, or does that come out of something else?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, there's certainly the New Testament reference to the wisdom of men, or the, how does it go, the wisdom of men is the foolishness of God, or, I mean, there's that reference, that's where it comes from, but exactly how it was practiced or how that was talked about in the Middle Ages, I couldn't tell you where. I couldn't give you any references there.
Thank you.
Anybody else before we... There wasn't one. Okay, thank you all. Next week, we're actually going to finish the Middle Ages and get into the Renaissance and maybe even start on the Reformation a little bit.